Good evening. You are listening to The Talking Show on Kaechung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio station for the arts. Now, under the umbrella company of the Museum of Contemporary Art Los Angeles. Welcome.
They really heard the message, right? That they were like, oh, this is the only micro-broadcasting radio station for the arts. We are an arts institution. We should get them.
Yeah, we should gobble them up because they're gathering a lot of steam and presence here in the arts landscape of Los Angeles.
You know, I mean, to be fair, like I was saying about being at OPAF last week, there's always new people at Kaechung. You know, it's by far one of the longest running and has had like the healthiest turnover of almost any sort of like artist run organization I've been involved in. So, you know, we are a little snide since we've been around forever and we've seen everything that the station can be. But at the same time, you know, cheers to Kaechung, right? Like, it's not nothing to be like a 12-year-old DIY radio station, you know?
It's true. It's true. And for you listeners that are just tuning in after 12 years of broadcasting, I'm Nicholas Miller, and this right here is Steve
sorry.
Cato.
Yeah, that's right. I'm Steve Cato.
That's Steve Cato. We are The Talking Show. We are the longest-running show on Kaechung.
Been here for all 12 of those years.
Which has really paid off, because now we just collect our big fat checks from Mocha and enjoy most days. Steve cycling.
Yep.
I play football. European football, and that's pretty much all.
I like
we do.
How we're introducing ourselves to the listeners for the first time. You know, it's like when you're learning a new language, and you're just like, "Ja, ich heiße Nicholas Miller. ich so liebe die Fußball auch meine Freund Steven liebe." Cycling,
May
Canal,
May and Kanta, vinyl records.
Oh, don't say that too loud. Remember, this is a really controversial topic for us.
Oh, true. You know, I actually haven't bought a vinyl record in years. I'd say I bought one during the lockdown. Bob James's Obsession. Have you heard that record?
No. I feel like. With a name like that, I'm reluctant. I feel like what Bob James gets up to in the privacy of his home is up to Bob James, and it's no business of mine. And that's how I feel about it. I don't know. Is there something I should know?
I mean, if you're afraid of what he does just on a daily basis at his home, you don't want to know about his obsession, because it's quite intense.
I have to say that. Long time listeners will know this, but I have moved a lot, and I've moved internationally often while we have been doing this show. When we started doing this show, I lived in Denmark and Canada, for example, and I would fly every Wednesday to Los Angeles to record the show. And one of the things that really sucks about moving is moving your record collection. There's that Walter Benjamin unpacking my library thing. And the only thing and the only thing that's kind of like more insane, I think, than unpacking a library is unpacking a record collection. Cause like your record collection isn't exactly like a library, you know, cause there aren't really subjects to records, right? It's just sort of like name and recognition and then chronology. Like it's like a very slimmed down version of how you would categorize a library, you know, because it's like if you were sorting your library, you'd be like, oh, there's poetry, there's like nonfiction books. This is where all the books about Aztecs go. This is where all the books about insects go. This is where all the books about Norse mythology go, or whatever. This is where art monographs go. You know, novels are over here by author and by date. You know,
don't you have genre music in music?
Well, you might. But that's like the scarce separation, really. You know what I mean? And like maybe a compilation soundtrack section or something, you know?
True.
But otherwise, it's like a, you know, but the thing is that like it's just criminally heavy, like considering the size of the objects, like a box of books that's the same size as a box of records, you might get luck out and you might have some of those like books printed on thinner, lighter paper. For example, you know, you might have some cheapies in there, right? Like not every book is printed with the good stuff, but like even the worst pressed records on the thinnest, most like egregiously cheap vinyl are still like solidly printed on a disc of vinyl. So like, and the trend with reissues is that the vinyl is getting really heavy. So now you've got like grams and grams of vinyl per record. And so your record collection is like your book collection, but it doesn't make you smarter necessarily. And it's like twice as heavy.
Yeah.
It's twice as dense. And moving it around was just terrible. And but during the pandemic, I felt so bad for my friends who are still trapped in the cycle of music making that I was like, I'll buy your new LP, buddy. You know, and then people were pushing it. They realized that like lots of people's sympathies were being bent this way. And so, you know, I think many record labels and such were like, oh, you know what? Why don't you buy, we're reissuing that Paulina Oliveros record that you really like, you know, there's only going to be 200 of these. You should definitely, you know, and like it worked on me, you know? Ooh. So I've been buying like a couple records a month.
Oh my goodness, Steve.
Yeah.
Those 180 grams a piece add up.
No, it's, I'm going to pay for this later. I already kind of regret it. because it's also like one of those situations where, I mean, there are records that I do have and enjoy. I think we understand that there are like records that are like our favorite records together. Both of us really enjoy these records, and I have a nice copy of Private Parts, the Robert Ashley record, you know, with the gray cover, which is rare, I understand, compared to the one with the yellow cover. I'm happy to have these things, but I have them just kind of like, I don't actually put on the record when I want to listen to Private Parts, you know?
Yeah.
I keep that record in a bag and when I want to listen to Private Parts, I have like a deluxe FLAC file that I can play through my, you know, bit perfect sound card, into my stereo. And it's great, you know? That's what I do. And I do that because it's also convenient. I don't have to go to a shelf. I can just like scroll on my phone and select that and have that like bop on out over, you know, on the other device.
I've seen him do it, folks. It's pretty slick.
It's wild. And I'm playing these high fidelity audio files. Anyway, so it's like, you know, what am I doing this for? But then on the other hand, I like to think that like, you know, there are lots of the records I buy are pretty weird music. And I'd like to think that it's good that someone's supporting these people.
Right.
It's not popular. It's not a good, it's not good for you to make this kind of music. So, if I like it, you're probably doing it wrong. So, you need all the help you can get. So I'm more than happy to throw $20 your way. But yeah, anyway, what's in your bag, Nicholas?
Oh, well, I haven't, I just
Bob James's obsession.
Bob James's obsession. My bag's been pretty empty the last couple of years. I think cause I was in a similar place you were in, you are in.
Yeah.
In terms of like moving a lot and thinking like, this is a really stupid thing to carry around. And also, you know, committing to digital audio in a way, but I lately have been trying just to find more and more ways of getting away from the computer, away from the screen.
And so
in the evenings after dinner, sometimes we'll read in the living room. And I find that, you know, if I'm launching stuff from my phone, then like I'll see a text message and then 30 minutes will pass cause I'll get into something.
Yeah.
Whereas if I leave my phone in the other room and I play records, it's not a concern. So, and also I realized, you know, I started watching the series What's in Your Bag that Amoeba Records puts out, and I haven't been to Amoeba in a very long time. I think last time I went was with Matt Siegel, like when I lived in Silver Lake. We went, that was like a date he proposed, and it was fun. And I was thinking about that today, and I thought, that social component of it is gone too. I should go to a record store every once in a while, even just to see other dorks like milling about. But I did, and so my nostalgia led me to the Amoeba Records video page on YouTube, and I watched several of their What's in Your Bag series, and there's some, a lot of boring ones, but there's some real stunners in there, I can tell you that right now. First of all being Big Boy from Outkast.
Mm.
You want to take a guess
Wonderful
on
band.
What was in his bag?
No, I'll tell, share, dish.
Much to my surprise, it was filled almost entirely with Kate Bush records.
Wow.
And I wasn't writing.
I have such love for Outkast.
Me too. And at first I thought, well, Big Boy's just riding the, you know, the recent Kate Bush wave cresting right off the Stranger Things television show. But this video, I think, was from 6 years ago or something like that. So,
yeah.
He's a genuine fan. Which I guess, with some reflection, makes sense. He kind of cast it as like he was introduced to Kate Bush as a teenager, and her way of incorporating costume, video, theater, all of these things is really compelling to him, and, you know, played out a little bit with his collaboration in Outkast.
Yeah, and I mean, didn't he and Andre 3000 like meet at the Arts High School in Atlanta?
Oh, I'm not sure about that. That would make sense.
I think it's something like that. So it's like, you know, it's like, I get it. I know. I see how you guys, you know, cooked this thing up.
Sure.
Right? Like that. I get it. Yeah. You know, what's funny is I, every Christmas or so I go to Amoeba just in case there's like easy gifts for people, you know, like if I was to find a funny, lovely music record or something like that, you know, I've got people I could give that record to.
Mm-hmm.
And I inevitably fully enter like weird picker mode where it's like, I will go first. Well, everyone knows that the smart strategy is first you go to the things that they just put out, because by the time stuff gets out to the actual bins, right? Like any true heads have already been through, right?
Yeah.
So like the stuff they put out today is your only chance of scoring like that thing that will surprise everyone that you found. And of course, unfortunately, like the staff at Amoeba also know how to price records correctly. So you're not going to get, it's really unlikely that you're going to get surprised by a bargain somewhere. You know, you're not going to be like, well, golly, this record's normally $30, but they've only got it here for $5. You know, like you're never going to experience that moment of joy. The people who work there know far too well what these records are worth. But your chances of finding anything truly strange are there. And when I'm there, though, I'm always like, wow, look at all this weird stuff. And they'll be like, you know, like a record I've never heard of by someone who's like, I recognize to be like a friend of a friend or like a member of some other thing that I know about. And I'm just like, oh, for $7 or something, I'm just going to buy this. I still haven't listened to any of those records, by the way. They're all just in a stack by my turntable. But like every once a year, I sort of drift in there and do the sort of like, oh, and like I actually just do regular record shopping where I don't have any idea what most of the stuff is that I end up buying. I just sort of have associations with it, and then that's what I end up leaving with. You know, you're like, oh, so-and-so, if it's produced by this guy, it's probably pretty interesting. Oh, $7. What if this is great? You know, like, is it? I don't know. Haven't listened to it.
Yeah.
No idea.
It's in Steve's recently arrived pile.
Yeah. Closing in on 9 months old, recently arrived pile. Yeah, like, absolutely. That's the trouble I'm in. And inevitably, you know, there is no stuff for the gift list at the end of the day. Like I'm always just sort of like, well, you know, or like I found one weird, that like a weird, Robert Ashley associated record, and I was like, you know what, this is $40, I'm buying this, that's what's happening, that this Christmas shopping trip is over. I'm getting these like six never heard of before records and this one Robert Ashley record, and I'm paying, you know, $80 and leaving, and that was my trip to Amoeba. I think the brain pattern is just too ingrained. Like if I was to like regularly go there, I would regularly do that. Yeah. You know? And the situation would become untenable.
Right. And expensive.
And for what? You know what I mean? Like, no one cares how good my taste in music is.
No, if you're not listening to them, it's not worth it.
And I mean, and also like, it doesn't reflect well on me or poorly on me or anything. Like no one, you know, like the angel of death doesn't come by my door and say like, oh, look.
Nor does a curator pop over and say like, oh, you've got that record. You want a solo show?
Yeah, no. The things I want in life are absolutely unconnected to these records I've bought and not listened to. So, yeah. Anyway, so what we're telling you folks is, let Amoeba go bankrupt.
please don't.
Records. Fill don't those buy
bags.
Them.
Yeah. Fill those bags.
Don't buy any records.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the entertainment industry, that we have here in Los Angeles, California, we have not invited a local entertainment worker from the music sector of our economy here. Instead, tonight we have a film director and screenwriter fresh from Venice, California, all the way out here in Chinatown. I'd like everyone to settle in to some gentle talking with Nicole Holofcener.
So do you like Los Angeles?
Do you like it? I don't think about whether or not I like it. I just live here, and I like my life, so I guess I like my life here. I live in Venice. I can walk my dog. I got a little pool. We're near the beach. My friends and family are here.
So how long were you a New Yorker?
I moved to New York. My family moved to New York when I was 12. Mm-hmm. So I grew up there in the city, and then moved to Westwood, and that was a shock. I was like the only pale, dark-haired girl who talked like this. I got rid of that, I guess. I think I did anyway. And so I'm used to LA. You know, it's not like I live here because of the movie business.
Right.
I ended up here because my family was here.
It's just the right place to be.
I miss New York, and I think there are other places to live. I'm not sure, but I've heard.
Other places in the world.
I think so.
So your films are very personal, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they're not autobiographical purely.
Right.
But they do seem very personal. So does taking this one back to New York City a choice that was just the story fit, or?
It's just the story fit. I didn't feel like, oh, I got to get back to New York. Mm-hmm. I actually wrote it and thought, oh, why am I writing a story that has to take place in New York, because then I'll have to leave my kids. And I thought, well, it'll never get made anyway, or, you know, oh, well, I'll just change a few things and shoot it on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. But the story was so, there were so many things that were just too New York-y. I couldn't lose it.
Do you think of that way about making film? I mean, it seems like you're kind of on this wonderful path of making personal films that you get made each time. Or, I mean, are there films you haven't gotten made that you wanted to get made, or?
No. Oh, yeah. No. I got it made.
But I mean, each time you do it, do you?
Yeah, each time I do it.
This time it's not going to happen?
Oh, yeah. I don't sit there writing thinking, this is going to be a great movie released by. I mean, I have a movie now I'm trying to get financed that I'm pretty sure we won't get financing. It's really different from my movies, and we need more money. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, because each time I try to make a movie, it really seems like we're not going to get the money.
Mm-hmm.
So I know what that feels like. Not get the money, and then get the money.
So the money fairy just arrives, and
you twist enough arms, convince. I mean, Sony Classics thought, you know, that Please Give wasn't going to be funny, and that was what their concern was—that it was just all dark.
Mm-hmm.
And so Catherine Keener actually called them up and offered to act out the scenes that she thought would be funny, and she didn't have to do that, but I did have to go through the script with them. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're incredibly intelligent men, you know. I think that it's my limitation as a writer that you can't read the script and know it's going to be funny. Mm-hmm. I think it's maybe too vague, but I knew that parts of it were going to be really funny. And once I convinced them and showed them, this is funny here, this is going to be funny here, and actually things in the movie turned out funny that I didn't even think would be funny.
Like?
I don't remember.
Is Ann Gilbert, do you expect Ann Gilbert to be as funny or get as many laughs as she gets?
No. No, I didn't think that. Like, you know, she's sitting at the dining table and, you know, the kid's got the underwear on their head and she says, you know, who is that? Is that funny? And I knew that that would be like a funny thing to say, like my granny would say something like that, but it gets a huge laugh. You know, and when she's eating the cake,
yeah,
that gets a huge laugh. That was, I think that was improvised. I'm not sure. Or we made it up.
She's very funny. It just occurs to me. See, this is a classic thing. We haven't put a microphone on you.
No,
I'm pretty
way.
Sure we've heard you through all of this, we probably should. It's like hanging over the edge of the.
That's probably okay.
There. We're probably hearing you, but better to hear you
shit.
Perfectly.
Yeah.
Clipping a microphone on is always fun. Ta-da.
There it is.
See, if only Penelope Cruz had done that, it would have been so much better. She was wearing a wife beater t-shirt, and they put it on her shoulder. Her people put it on her shoulder.
Yeah.
And her hair, her lustrous
just
hair. Yeah, so Pedro and I. She was lovely, but outside from
that. She's so gorgeous. I just watched Broken Embraces.
And she seems to actually be a nice person.
A nice, smart person, really?
Yeah.
It's not possible.
I know. It's weird, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Someone can look like that.
Did you feel like you grew up in this business? I mean.
Yeah. I guess I did.
So is it surprising to you that people are what they are? And Catherine is kind of like the touchstone for everybody who wants, like, the earth.
That's great.
And directors love Catherine
yeah.
in this very intense, very personal, real way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But a lot of actors, not so much.
Not so much. I grew up, yeah, I guess there were some crazy actors in my parents' lives, yeah. But I didn't, you know, you don't really know what they're going to be like until you're working with them. Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean? You mean?
Is that the intimacy of actually getting on a set and working through the,
oh yeah,
doing the work?
Yeah, I think, because personally, you can know somebody in a certain way and then how they act when they're under pressure or how they act when they have to be, you know, made up,
mm-hmm.
you know, or shot from a certain angle, or you never know, or insecure, or don't like the other actor. Yeah, they can be pretty, pretty nutty.
You get surprised by that? I mean, you kind of hire
sometimes.
Somebody thinking, I really kind of know who this person is, and then.
Yeah, like on one of my movies, an actor was mad because his turnaround was not respected, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so he didn't show up the next day. And I said to the producer, you're kidding, right? Like, but he's got a scene. And he was like, no, he's not. He's pissed, and he's going to be late on purpose. And I was just stunned. And I can see from his point of view, you know, how he rationalized that that's mm-hmm. what he should do. But I didn't understand that people could act like that.
Well, you don't have a lot of room for that on your budget.
No,
so
and it's never happened since. And it was probably a mistake, you know, that his
right.
turnaround was over
yeah.
overseen. But yeah, there's no room for any of that. I mean, we're taking naps on the couch of the set. It's not like a luxurious environment.
Mm-hmm. So for you, is it all writing first? I mean, are you a writer first?
No,
and
I direct
director
first,
second?
And then I write the script.
I've seen those movies.
It's fun. Yeah, I have too. no, well, yeah, I guess I'm a writer first because I never thought that I'd be a director. So
mm-hmm.
I had hoped that I'd be a writer. And then when I went to film school, I thought, oh, maybe I can be a director. And if I couldn't direct, I would still hopefully write.
So you come out of film school saying, I want to be a writer-director?
Yeah.
And make personal movies?
Yeah, although I probably never said that out loud. And make personal movies.
Well, I mean, was that what you were thinking when you came out, or did you want to make Armageddon?
I guess I wanted to make personal Armageddon. Smaller
yeah,
personal Armageddons. Emotional Armageddon.
Those moments are there.
Yeah. I guess. I wanted to, you know, tell my stories. I didn't know how many stories I'd have in me. I knew
mm-hmm.
I wanted to tell that one when I got out of film school, Walking and Talking. And it took many years later.
So does it evolve naturally with your life changing? I mean,
yeah.
I kind of wondered in this movie whether, you know, the passing of Mr. Jaffe was
mm-hmm.
part of the choice to deal with parents passing and all
mm-hmm.
that.
I know he died right after we finished shooting.
Oh, so...
But nevertheless, I mean, parents aging for sure,
yeah.
and my grandma dying a while ago, and just getting older myself, I think. I didn't know I was going to write a movie about this until I'd written it, really.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really plan it, but I think about death all the time.
Hmm.
Now that you have a child, maybe you do too. It's a horrifying prospect, isn't it?
Well, it changes everything you see in the media and whatever.
Your little boy is going to be 60 and you won't be here.
Yeah.
Right? Isn't that weird?
Well, my mother's first reaction, who is 79 or whatever she is now, was that, you know, we now have a family member who will live into the next millennium. It was like the first words out of her mouth.
But
not
bitch.
Next millennium, I guess. But the next century. The next century.
Right.
I'm like making him a little older than he is.
Yeah, he's going to be 1,000 years old.
But they don't actually see 2100.
Right.
It was her idea of like.
Right. That's the idea of the birth of her grandchild.
Yeah.
She sounds weird.
Yeah, she's weird. Well, you know. That's why I'm doing this. I'd have to make personal movies. Otherwise, it would be horrifying. So I'd like Doug Block do it for me. I'm with 51 Birch Street and all that stuff.
Who?
Doug Block. He's a documentarian who made movies about his family.
You know,
pretty.
I don't believe in documentaries. I'm joking. Didn't I say it in a jokey way?
You're close.
You look so hurt.
Well, you don't always know where to go with that.
Yeah, I guess.
Because I didn't really believe you, but I thought it was possible. Do you like documentaries?
Yeah, I love documentaries.
I don't believe
in them, but I like them.
What kind of movies do you like generally? What are your...
I guess more character-driven, indie movies, probably. Mm-hmm. I love the Coen brothers. I love all kinds of movies if they're really good, right?
Yeah.
I do.
But, like, the Coens are a lot more tricky than you choose to be, as a filmmaker, I would say.
I couldn't even try to be as tricky as them and clever. And they have such diverse stories to tell, you know. I don't know. I'd like to be able to get outside of my own navel-gazing and mm-hmm. write about other things. But I seem unable to at the moment.
Well, is it hard to do that in terms of, or are you being conscious of it, that, you know, you've had so much success doing the navel-gazing? I mean,
I know.
If that's
well,
what
like,
it is?
Well, I feel like, yeah, it's not broken. You know, why try to fix it? And yet, yeah, I guess. I mean, if I only make this kind of movie and I can make them and enough people see them, then I've done it. I don't have to do anything else. But I guess I'd like the challenge of doing another kind of movie.
Are there specific filmmakers who inspire your work, or
that I try to copy?
Well,
the Coen brothers. Certainly movies that I grew up watching by, you know, all the great filmmakers. Like, listing them always feels kind of cliche.
Yeah.
But
well, did you watch the Z Channel as a child, or were you watching?
Of course. As a child, I saw the regular movies a kid would see. I guess I saw a lot of, I don't know, I better hurry up and say something.
Freaky Friday?
No editing. I saw movies that, like, scared the shit out of me when I was a kid. Picture Mommy Dead. I remember my parents. That's a real movie, right?
I don't know.
My parents had a projector in our living room, and we showed all the Woody Allen movies, and like I would have a party. I think my 10th birthday party, we showed Sleeper, maybe. And
did Woody show up?
No.
Oh, okay. That would be like a really special.
What?
If Charlie could get Woody to actually come out to LA.
Yeah, exactly. No, we were in New York.
In New York, even easier.
But
come across the park.
Yeah. He was over at our house sometimes, but not at my 10th birthday party. And my parents would show adult movies to their adult friends at night, and I remember they were showing Picture Mommy Dead.
Mm.
And I came out in my nightgown and saw it, and I was just wrecked forever. I peaked. Jerry Lewis movies. My dad liked to take me to those. And W.C. Fields movies. I saw a lot of those when I was a kid. Mm. And, you know, and then older, just the regular kind of film student movies like Scorsese and Truffaut and Fellini and Buñuel and all those good movies.
Was film school critical to you being able to do what you do? I mean, was that a great, great experience, or was it?
It was both. It was like a lot of tears and a lot of pats on the back. I remember this one teacher. She was so awful. I hope she's watching this right now. I don't remember her name. Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do.
She can be Googled.
I know. She's probably dead. Okay. And she was so mean. I remember with Walking and Talking, she said, it was mean only because, well, she said, this is obviously a movie about lesbians. And she was a lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it's not like the worst thing to be called was a lesbian, but I wasn't, and that's not what the movie was about. And she said it really, really nasty, and she didn't like it, and it had no plot. She was really mean. I remember having tears, crying from her. So film school could
And is that Columbia or NYU?
That was at Columbia. Yeah. And that, so film
We're getting school, closer to who it really is.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. You can find out, figure it out.
Right.
And it's brutal because, you know, they all have opinions and they're paid to have opinions, your teachers and your fellow students telling you how shitty your stuff is. I guess towards the end, and I got better at what I was doing and probably a thicker skin.
Did you have a sense of being, of knowing the real business versus knowing being in school, or was it just very personal and close? And
no, when you're in film school, it's just film school.
Right.
You know, that was the world.
For me, it wasn't. That's why.
Oh, did you go?
I went to NYU film school.
Oh, you did?
In the very early days of Tisch.
Oh, like Nick Tanis and Sight and Sound? And
yeah.
Oh, you had Hank Mnuchin?
No, he was, I think he had just.
What are you, 80?
No. I mean, well, maybe Hank. Is it Haig?
Isn't that his name? Haig.
Haig.
I didn't have him.
So no. I was like Haig. In the Cam Galana era.
I don't know who that is.
She works for New Line.
Or Susan now
she works
Seidelman?
Seidelman was already making movies.
Oh, okay.
She was, I guess I
went to school. Oh, you're
young. I'm a baby.
You're younger than everybody.
But back then it was only one building instead of
the
entire Greenwich Village.
Is it now? Because
Well, they own the 8th Street Playhouse. They own the theater on 8th Street that's like on the other side of University that was a public house and now NYU owned. Yeah, they like bought everything.
Wow. I went there for a year and a half at the end of college and in the film department. And did you sleep outside that building to get equipment and everything too?
No, I was not. I was wanting to be a producer at the time, so which is something you can't really do with film school, I found.
Mm-hmm.
At least in my film school. So I was kind of doing things uptown. Uh-huh. I was leaving school a lot.
So you were part of the real world when you were in film
school? Yeah, I was very conscious of the real world, and
right.
I was very, it was a bit of a head spinner. Because they all tell you you're going to be a director, and in case you were, you became one. I didn't really want to be one, so.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was a kind of like fanciful idea of what the world was like.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
Different experience.
Yeah. It's very insulated and very different when you get out.
Were there films being made that were like Walking and Talking? Were there other films in the marketplace that fit and she hated all of those? Or?
Oh, I don't know. She just hated me. But no, but there were a lot of films. I mean, there were films were starting to be made that I wanted to make movies like. That didn't make sense, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I saw Sex, Lies, and Videotape when I was in film school. So it's like, oh my God, I am doing the right thing. You know, somebody got this made and is making a lot of money and everybody loves it and I want to make a movie like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I did have some guidance. And Jane Campion had made a couple of movies too by then. And I volunteered at the New York Film Festival and, got to see a lot of independent movies that when I was in film school in New York that made me think it could be possible.
So when you actually got behind the camera as a director, are you obsessed or interested in or terribly concerned about the shots and things like, I mean, are you sitting there storyboarding things out, or are you trying to create a live event on the stage and
shooting
it?
You mean now, when I work?
I guess, well, one from the beginning and now? Or?
From the beginning, I felt like I was supposed to know all about foot candles. I mean, they teach you everything in film school, and I thought that's what you needed to be a director, or else you look like an asshole if you don't.
Right.
Especially being female, I felt like, well, if I come on the set and go, I don't know, just put that long lens thing on, you know, then I'd be sabotaging myself. And yet, that's actually kind of how I've turned out. Because I don't care what people think about me anymore. And I just say, just put that long lens on. And he'll say, well, you know, this number. And I'll say, I think this number. Or show me and I'll pick. I don't feel the pressure anymore to know the stuff that doesn't really interest me. Like all of the lenses or the colors and the filters. And the. I feel like I know enough. And with each movie, I want definitely for them to look better and better.
Mm-hmm. But you're not really worried about crane shots. Got to have a crane shot in the second act.
Well, not for the purpose of having a crane shot.
Right.
I can't even write that way anymore because everything's so low budget. Like, I'm so used to just putting people in a room and having them talk that Like sometimes I do a job for a studio, like a rewrite job, mm-hmm. and they say, you know, these characters can leave the room. We do have like $40 million to make this movie. You right. can have, you know, camera angle above the house, going, or, so I'm just so accustomed to cheap movies.
Well, that's what people, I think, are, I mean, your special effects.
Right.
I think are your actors.
Right, they're pimples. Those are my special effects in this last movie. It was the fake pimples.
Yes. But I mean it is the intimacy. It is the mm-hmm. I mean if right. you tried to do the other stuff, it might be amusing to look at that from a DP standpoint, but
right.
it's not the things we remember from your movies are right. those moments of insane intimacy mm-hmm. that you generally don't see in mm-hmm. films.
Good. Yeah, I just directed recently directed an episode of Bored to Death. Mm-hmm. And there's this amazing crane shot. And it was like, when's the crane shot going to be over? You know, I have nothing mm-hmm. to do with that.
Right.
You know, I can say started here and ended here, and then 5 hours later, the crane shot's done, you know, and it looks great, but it's definitely not what I'm there for.
So is it fun to do other stuff that's not your personal stuff?
Yeah, it was fun.
Because it's freeing or because it's...
Yeah, it's a little freeing to get out of my own work. I like working with new actors, if they're nice. And if the crew is a happy crew, it's a nice place to sort of visit for a while.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, you know, they want me there, so I don't have to prove myself, really. And if I like the show, it's great. Because
mm-hmm.
then I want everyone to be happy with what I'm doing, and it's funny, and we're laughing, and it's, yeah, I like it.
Do you get surprised by what they call you in for say, rewrites or whatever, or you, is it...
No.
Have you been boxed in that way?
I've been boxed in.
So they come to you looking for smart women talking fast?
Yeah. yeah. Or not so smart women
right.
talking fast. Yeah. And I get sent those kind of scripts to direct sometimes, too. But not. I haven't found anything yet that I really loved enough. I mean, there was one thing, but I couldn't end up doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But... yeah, romantic comedies, maybe with a bigger hook than what, you know, I would come up with. And they want, you know, dialogue polish and
mm-hmm.
make this female character more human, things like that.
So is that just a muscle stretch or just cash or?
It's good money, really good money.
Yeah.
You know, it is a muscle stretch. I wouldn't do it if I didn't have to make money. I would just write my own stuff.
Right.
But as jobs go, it's a great job, especially because I do pick a script that I can live with for a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like I take one that I hate. I take right. one that I like.
So in this case, you have a teenage girl.
Yeah.
Your kids are, I gather, 12 or so. And you were a teenage girl at one point. Is that, where did she come from? Because she is, I mean, as yeah. much as her parents are the center of this and the grandmother yeah. is at the center of this,
yeah.
there's this girl really, I think, is the emotional middle of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So where did she come from?
I guess she's me, because she just kind of popped up out of nowhere. She's not based on anyone in particular. I have a niece, a 17-year-old niece, and I do hear a lot about her arguments with her mom, and I think that without being conscious of it, that's how it ended up in the script, although that character's nothing like my niece. And I had terrible skin as a teenager. It took over my world. You know,
mm-hmm.
I still had a pretty good teenagehood, but it was all about the zits for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And before I knew it, you know, that character was just talking to her mom about zit medicine, and I don't know. I got along better with my mom, I think, than they do in the movie. My mom mm-hmm. did have more compassion for me without me having to make a movie
yeah.
about it, but... I guess that's where she came from.
Well, I kind of got also that she would, for me, the having Oliver Platt as her dad,
mm-hmm.
I mean, in some ways, she is stuck with his genes besides just her skin.
Mm-hmm.
She also isn't, you know, as sleek as Catherine
right.
And has to kind of live with that. And it's mm-hmm. kind of, there's just all kinds of areas where you're sympathetic and she is beautiful.
Yeah. yeah.
And she's also not in certain ways. And mm-hmm.
It would be hard to have Catherine be your mother if you were a daughter. And you didn't look as beautiful as Catherine
yeah.
and as glamorous, you know? I mean, I didn't want to cast.
Well, she's trying so hard not to look that way.
Right. You think?
I think she, I mean, I think in this movie in particular, but I mean, sometimes she glams up, but mm-hmm. she's not really, I never get the sense, I rarely get the sense with her that she's trying to look beautiful and glamorous.
Right.
She just,
if anything, has she
bone
wants
structure
to kind of,
and everything else.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's hard to be stuck with that. Or without it, I guess.
I know. And not really on purpose. I mean, I didn't want to cast, you know, a model for a daughter.
Right.
Definitely not, because I knew I was going to put the zits on her face. But, I think she looks like Catherine and Oliver,
mm-hmm.
You know?
She really
like
does.
She could be their kid, except she's short, and they're not short.
Huh.
But can't have everything.
So was she cast after them?
Both? Yeah. Yeah, she was cast kind of pretty late. I auditioned a lot of girls,
mm-hmm.
A lot of good girls. But when she came in, that was that. Her whole face and neck broke out in a blush that I'm probably in right now because I'm on camera. Hope not.
You look fine.
Yeah, will you tell me if there's like something weird hanging?
I'll tell you. Anything falls into, yeah, anything drips, I'll let you know. I'm very big on dripping these days.
Really?
Three
yeah.
3 month old at home.
Yeah, exactly. If I just start to drool. I remember that when my kids had, till he was really old, it looks like it was always wet right here.
And usually me
and
as
in
well.
Here, yeah. What was I saying? Oh, she flushed. Yeah. And I love that, you know, because she was so present. You know, she was doing the scene and like yelling at
mm-hmm.
the casting director.
And where did Rebecca come from?
England. She, Jeannie McCarthy, the casting director, said, oh, I think this girl's, she's kind of hot right now, which can help.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's great and lovely and you should meet her. So I met her and then I watched Starter for 10, which she's in.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that. I was sold. She was perfect.
And she kind of also was an interesting match
with
Amanda.
Yeah,
because they do look like sisters, even though they
think?
Don't look anything alike.
That's just the magic of fake relationships.
Maybe.
Because they don't look remotely alike.
No. But you could kind of see where like two different parents would, you know, like there'd be like the
mm-hmm.
different nose and the
mm-hmm.
different.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I'm thinking about Rebecca's accent the whole time anyway, so.
Oh, good. You were really involved in the movie.
Well, no, not the whole time. I do this for a living. So.
She did it. She did it pretty well.
Yeah, no, she did great.
Yeah. There's one line she says. You know, should have looped it, Rebecca. Should have looped it. I think we tried. She did a great job.
And Anne?
Audition. Same.
Just really an audition?
Yeah, because I didn't know of her.
So what is an 80-year-old casting call like?
Oh, it's weird. I didn't actually meet her. She had been put on tape, and it was sent to me. But I did audition a ton of older women. It was weird because... Mostly because they would come in, and mm-hmm. I'd think, that's her. That's her. She's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd talk to me, and we'd have a nice conversation. And then as soon as the video camera went on, and she'd start reading the scene, she started acting like an old lady, like how an old lady is supposed to act.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was not real. You know, like, oh, well, I'm going to talk like this, and then I'm going to talk like that, or be feisty. Or, and, it, you know, it is my fault that I didn't direct them more. I could have said... Mm-hmm. You know, you're already 90. You don't have to act 90. But I wouldn't have said that. That would have
right.
been bad. But something similar. I just was going with someone who's really natural. And it's not that Anne didn't need direction, you know, but she just got it.
Well, I guess they're actors who are of that age. They've been around long enough because of their acting still. They must
right.
have done something
right.
that they're like have their shtick.
I know. Right.
And they
kinda, think that's what you want.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I'd say to Jeannie, I was like, you know, who was that actress that was so fake? Who was that person? And she said, oh, she just won the Tony.
Right.
Be like, what?
Yeah.
Doing that, you know, exact thing, which, you know, is the opposite of what
it's
I
was. It's like Marty Short is doing Damages this season, and he's actually acting. And
uh-huh.
you're like,
mm-hmm.
and I appreciate him more, I think,
mm-hmm.
now than I ever
mm-hmm.
have before.
Mm-hmm. Is he good?
All the energy is great.
Yeah.
But when you see him stripped of all that
yeah.
shtick.
Right.
It's like, oh, look, he can, you know, you see stuff in his eyes, and you're...
Mm-hmm.
You're having a real experience with him as an actor, as opposed to,
mm-hmm.
ta-da,
right.
which is
Jiminy Glick.
Yes,
which is Jimmy Glicker. Yeah.
So I see how this fantasy that you knew Anne as a child and.
Oh really? She's my grandma.
Did you grow up with her as a child?
Yeah.
Did you know who?
Oh
she,
yeah. yeah,
yeah.
I mean, I watched the Dick Van Dyke Show, and when I saw her, I was like, oh my God, that's Millie Helper, and. And then she'd do these things on the set, you know, like laugh a certain way and kind of go, like that, which was, it's like, oh my God, that's her. And it's like, yeah, that's her, because that's still her.
And she has no fear, apparently, of being, I mean, because she's, it's a tough character a lot of the time, mm-hmm. with her menopause red hair and all of that. And she really kind of like lets it loose.
She didn't care. I went to her house the other day and we were just talking about plastic surgery and, you know, how crazy she thinks it all is and how she doesn't mind looking wrinkled. And she's a lot more attractive in person than she is in the movie. She has, like, soft gray hair, and she's always laughing, you know. So she's great looking.
Well, I guess her career was being Vivian Vance early on. Right, you know, she chose that role that she was pretty good woman. I mean, beautiful woman, young woman. But yet she was a sidekick next to Mary Tyler Moore. It's kind of tough to shine that way.
I know, and Mary Tyler Moore, beautiful. Yeah.
So,
how do you remember what to ask me?
I don't. I'm trying to have a conversation with you. Is it working?
Yeah.
Are we chatting? Is that going well?
Oh my God, there's a camera here.
I know.
I was so relaxed.
Damn it. It's like being at a bar mitzvah and having, you know, doing the wrong thing at a table and getting caught with a video camera.
Right.
So you go through the process of making this movie. Does it change much? I mean, is it pretty much you just shoot what you are on the page and then edit what's on the
I would say mostly it stays the same. Things change all the time, like that line when she says, "How's that cake, Andra?" You know, which gets such a big laugh in the movie. And that was, you know, like we were shooting the scene and making so many jokes, and that was one of them that maybe Oliver said, and I said, she should say dry or shitty or, you know, something, and that one stuck. Oliver Platt had a lot of ideas when he read the script that he wanted to change, and a lot of things about his character that really improved it. Like the scene when they're at the dinner table, they're at a restaurant, it's the only scene they're in a restaurant, and Oliver sees the guy and says, oh, that guy looks like the kid's grandpa, because he's questioning kind of how he looks and his aging. And he completely made that all up in advance. I mean, thank God.
Right.
It wasn't like, oh, I have an idea at the last minute. He gave me, you know, we would talk about the scene and we were trying to figure out the best ways to express that character's unhappiness at the time.
And it was important to making him likable in the end.
Yes.
I mean, because that was probably, I think, maybe the hardest line to walk. I mean, Catherine is in her own space, and you understand why she's having some hard times with certain things. But his character really kind of...
It's less explained.
Yeah.
And he does a bad thing.
But you believe him, I think, in the end, that he
is
going somewhere better, or wants to, or learned a lesson.
Yeah. Good. I think so, too. And I think Oliver had a lot to do with that. You know, the performance and how we rewrote it together. So things change along the way always. And it's funny because I just was looking at the script, the last version of the script, and there's a lot of things that are different. I rarely remember how they got different, but they did.
When award season comes around, they'll send out the script with the way it is.
Right, that's right.
Instead of the way it was.
I know, right? The shooting script versus the actual script.
They made that mistake years ago with Road to Perdition, where they sent out the shooting script that was better than the movie.
Oh my God.
And you can kind of tell the things they had cut out of the movie that were really kind of good. And you wish they were there.
So that's why they do it now.
I think they always just,
transcribe the movie.
Transcription is much safer.
That's not so fun to read. I know.
And does somebody like Amanda Peet come in and just say, give herself over to you, knowing that you've made so many pretty actresses into something more complicated?
Yeah, she wanted me to mess with her early on. I mean, she'd auditioned for Lovely and Amazing, and I really liked her wanted to work with her over time, and I knew she wanted to work with me too. And then this part came up, and it was like, she'd be great. And you have to be orange, Amanda. Is that okay? She was great. She would do anything. She's a big clown. And really great on the set, and she's such a champ. Those sex scenes, she's a pro, really a pro. I was more embarrassed than anybody. They just went right at it, and they were clothed. I'm a prude, I guess, but she's great. Just right for it.
So it sounds like it was a love fest all around.
I know. Don't all movies sound like love fest? Doesn't make you want to throw up. They come to my house every night. We play poker.
and nobody ever loses.
Right. We all look amazing. It kind of was a love fest. Sometimes it was really stressful and miserable.
And then when you go through this process where you have to go out and sell it?
Yeah.
Is this something that makes you happy?
No. am I allowed to say
You're
that?
You're absolutely allowed to say it.
No. This is nice because we're having a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
The interviews and stuff, I mean, I want to do them. I want to reach an audience, and I want to reach as wide an audience as possible for once. So I'm willing and happy to do it. It's a good job. I just have to remember it's part of my job.
Right.
I don't have to enjoy it.
Do you just mind explaining what you were thinking when...
That's hard.
Is it hard artistically or personally? Or is it Michael Haneke very specifically will not explain things because he wants the audience to do that work.
Right.
Is it that kind of thing?
It's like you made a movie. Why do I have to... I'm not doing a monologue.
Right.
Right. I'm not that...
We should Twitter through every moment of the movie.
I think it's hard. It's not like I think like there's a moral thing or an ethical thing that I guess he might feel, you know, more strident about. Yeah, he's German, exactly. it's just really difficult for me to do it, to explain things. That's why I wrote a scene about it, is because I can't explain it that well. I can explain it this way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many answers, and I often feel inarticulate, especially when someone says, like, what's the ending mean? It's like, well, if you watch the whole film, you know, that's where it lands. It's hard to separate an ending like that.
Yeah.
So that's difficult, but...
And your films don't really end in that...
Well, that's why I get that question.
Definitive way.
That's why I get it. Like, well, what does that mean?
Yeah. That's kind of the pleasure of the film.
Well, thank you. But does that mean I have to go buy my kid those jeans? Seriously, I just read... Yes, that's what I'm telling you to do. And I get 10%. I just read an article that said, I really like the movie, but... At the end, I kind of felt like the whole thing was just to justify spending $200 on a pair of jeans for your kid.
Huh.
I was like, that's so stupid. Don't send me those.
Yeah.
So I was like, I don't want to see those.
And how much are the jeans you're wearing right now?
I know.
That's a good junket question, isn't it?
I know, it is. What are these? Too much. But I'm a grown-up.
That's right. You've earned your money.
That's right. I'm not growing anymore.
It's not going to change. Your size is not going to change.
Right, my shoe size.
At least until you start shrinking, in which case.
I think I have.
We're all a few years away from that, I think.
Yeah, I am.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Wow. Cool. Well, I have to kick it off with a sincere apology for the early audio troubles. Gunter had the night off. Mocha has pretty strict labor laws that they're imposing upon us, much to everyone's surprise. And we forgot to clip the mic to Nicole to begin with, but we got it sorted. I hope you all heard that okay. Yeah, we're very, very nice talking. I'm a huge fan of Nicole's movies. I haven't seen all of them, but I've seen a couple. I can definitely recommend Friends with Money and Please Give. Please Give is a hit. They're very breezy, gentle melodramas, mostly capturing upper middle class people. And I think one of the things I could liken them to would be like Douglas Sirk for Gen X.
If
that makes sense.
Yeah, because I haven't seen any of these movies.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they're kind of they're very breezy, very light. You know, these people just kind of everyday problems. One of the things that's quite profound is like, you know, since the characters are well off for the most part, In a way that the troubles they have are not material. For example, in Please Give, Catherine Keener, who's in all of her movies, runs a mid-century modern furniture store in New York. And like one of the main kind of tensions of the film is that she and her husband do pretty well with this store. And I didn't even know this happened, but of course this happens in New York. They've purchased their next door neighbor's apartment with the ambitions of destroying a wall and making their apartment gigantic. Uh-huh. But their next door neighbor, who they purchased it from, sold it because she's very old and in ailing health and needs the money for health care. And so they're kind of just like sort of waiting for her to die so they can expand their apartment. But they're quite nice to her at the same time, you know, feeding her and trying to help her take care of her and going to the pharmacy for her. But then there is, this, of course, this tension around the fact that they will benefit upon her death in an immediate and material way. But one of the haunting things about the films is that, you know, like, so there's often an affair, like a husband has an affair, but these things don't kind of blow out of proportion the way they do in most Hollywood movies. It's like the wife doesn't find out, the affair fizzles out, no one really cared. Like nothing resolves in any of her films, and in that way it feels very almost more cutting and haunting, because you're just like, oh, this is a bit closer to how the people I know and myself live. Like, you're just like things happen.
Yeah, it's like more emotionally honest or whatever.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, especially because like the emotional landscape of most movies is so insane.
Like, right. It's just zero to 100 every few minutes.
Which, like, when you do actually meet someone who's like that, you're like, well, that's too, like, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, when you meet someone who is like people in movies, you're like, oh, no. No, I don't want to hang out with you. You're terrible. This sucks. I hate this.
Right.
You know, like, it's not, it doesn't feel good to, like, hang out with someone who's, like, you know, totally nuts.
Yeah. No, the Hall of Center's films are a bit more like, you know, like the friend you have who has chronic back pain and you kind of can't help them. And you're like, oh, your back's hurting again. I'm so sorry. How's that going? And like, you can't tell like how they're like, it just kind of like, is like a backdrop to the relationship, the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, the back, how's the back this time? Oh, not good. Okay. Sorry. Like watching someone like kind of slowly struggle with something over like a decade.
Sounds great. This sounds like some of the stuff that I really enjoy about like Gentle Ackerman movies to an extent.
Yeah, yeah.
Although less her comedies tend to be less successful as well. She made like a couple sort of light Euro comedies in the sort of mid career before she sort of stopped doing fiction films almost altogether. Stopped doing fiction films that she created basically and did like literary adaptations and documentaries at the end. But, in that like Tomorrow We Move, you know, like that's like a light sort of semi-romantic multi-generational comedy that's also about the Holocaust, you know, and people have feelings, but no one has like really ginormous feelings.
Yeah.
Not something that Chantal Ackerman handles particularly well. I think that's the problem, right? Like the thing she's good at, she's better at. But yeah, this sounds really appealing to me. I'm really I'm looking forward to watching some of these movies.
Yeah, I think next up for me is Lovely and Amazing from 2001. I haven't seen it.
The names are good.
Yeah, the names.
Please give Lovely and Amazing. What was the other one you mentioned that you'd seen?
Friends with Money.
Yeah, that's a great name for a movie.
That one's pretty good. Also, I think she has...
But it's a really good name, you know? Like,
yeah. I mean, as you could tell from the way she was talking tonight, like, she's a sensitive, delicate person, it would seem, and, tries to just write in a way that explores the various emotional states of a character. And so I think for that reason, like, actors are drawn to working with her, even though they don't make much money. Like, in Friends with Money, Jennifer Aniston's in it, which I don't think she could normally afford... Cusack is in it, but Jennifer Aniston plays she taught at a private high school on the West Side and quits and then is like cleaning houses and just like getting high all the time. And like does a great job.
Yeah.
A great
I mean,
job.
I think that's what's in it for actors in general who like being actors.
Yeah.
You know, there's like a subset of actors who are like, I was discovered riding my motorcycle. And now I'm an actor, and you're like, okay, well, you don't have anything invested in this, but there's people who, you know, and they're maybe not the people you think, but there's people who like, have tried to be an actor their whole lives, kind of thing. And like, I'm sure these things feel really good to them to be in. Yeah. You know.
Well, it sounds like I've piqued your interest in Hall of Sinners films. I have a real treat for you if you do your
what
homework.
Is it?
So the last project she worked on, which I watched the other night, is called The Last Duel.
Okay.
Which is it's a film set in France in the 14th century and is about the last judicial duel that occurred in France, where, you know, like you went to court and the king decided this can't be decided by mortals. So we're going
to
let
the
God
way
decide.
This has to be settled is by a duel. Right.
Yeah, which is just
amazing.
Like a fight to the death with swords and stuff, not like a gun duel. And which they saw as God deciding, which is hilarious.
Yes.
Not just like the stronger
Providence.
The more stronger guy. So it's
well,
but
here's that they understood that it was the stronger guy, but it was a stronger guy by virtue of God.
Sure. Yeah. Exactly.
And also the luckiest guy.
True. True.
You know, because it's like strong guy. Maybe it's important, but what if like the little guy gets lucky? You know.
Yeah, it's true. That would be divine intervention.
It's all divine intervention. Either God made the one guy stronger and bigger, and that's proof that, you know, and he could have made the other guy stronger or bigger, but didn't.
Yeah.
So he's wrong.
There was no concept that God could be on vacation that day or something.
Yeah, or that none of these features were connected to God in any way.
Yeah. So here's the tasty setting. I think you should really watch some of Hall of Sinners, you know, solo works first. But this is a film... So it's about this what is considered the last duel. I think technically it wasn't, but whatever. So they have the two fellows who competed in the duel. They have both of their written accounts, or you know, their sons' written accounts, or whatever what happened, because it all centered around a rape. One fellow raped the other fellow's wife, and so the film is told in three parts: one from the husband's perspective, then from the rapist's perspective, then from the wife's perspective. And this is a Ridley Scott, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck feature film. And they realized
see the posters for this. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So they realized that they could not write the chapter, by the woman because one, they don't have the capacity to project themselves into any kind of feminine experience. And because they've basically been fully rewarded for being as macho as possible their whole lives.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And two, because they're, you know, as is often today and was often even more often then, there are very verbose written accounts from the two men, but the women.
But there's nothing.
Right. Yeah. So basically they brought Hall of Sinner in just to be like, can you write us woman?
So she writes 1/3 of the movie, basically.
Unclear, you know, like I don't. You know, they don't like attribute it line by line, but I did.
Yeah,
watch
I know, but it's like written by like not James Cameron,
Matt
Ridley
Damon,
Scott,
like and Nicole Hall of Sinner. Yeah,
that
I watched an interview with them, and they basically were like, yeah, we brought Nicole in because we wrote the woman's part, and it made no sense. And she's like, yeah, they just had her in negligees the whole time.
Wow.
I think that's just like an amazing money job for her. Like clearly not her main interest, but I'm sure she got paid well. It's quite a treat to watch that after watching like her own work.
I feel like Ridley Scott should do that more often.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. There's also just a bunch of like interesting 14th century stuff, assuming that they got their period parts accurate. There's some tasty tidbits in there. It's also a very corny movie, but Matt Damon has a mullet. That's pretty great.
Wow. Have we already talked about The Accountant? That's the last Ben Affleck movie I've seen.
Yeah. I'm going to take credit for introducing you to that. I think we were talking about like filmic depictions of autism or something.
Yeah, that would be on the list for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. He listens to metal music and rubs that bar on his shins or something.
And just like a film that fully weaponizes his intense lack of charisma.
Oh, you're going to love him in The Last Duel. He plays like, he plays like the overlord of Normandy. I think he's a prince technically. His hair is dyed blonde and he still has the Boston accent.
Nice.
He's like, yeah, behead him. It's pretty, pretty tasty.
I can't wait. Yeah. Well, this has been a lot of chit chat from us.
True. true. So everyone, go out. Don't start with The Last Duel. Start with some proper Hall of Center films. Please Give, Lovely and Amazing, Enough Said, Friends with Money. They're all great.
These names are so good. Like naming a movie Friends with Money or Enough Said or Lovely and Amazing.
Yeah.
What? What? It's like it's like they're almost like the names of like $16 cocktails, but they're not. You know, it's like it's like you could be like at the bar and you'd be like, "I'll have a Lovely and Amazing, please."
Yeah, or a Friends with Money.
Yeah. But then like there's just like this little difference that makes them not that. My favorite example of the $16 cocktail is there's like a drink. There's this absolutely empty hotel boutique hotel bar that feels like an airport waiting room that my friends and I like to go to in Toronto because the lights are like fully on and you can just like see whoever you're talking to. If you wanted to like if you're waiting for someone, you're reading a book, you can like really easily read your book, you know, they have great drink specials. Things are real cheap. Well, they're not really cheap. They're nice enough, but cheap enough kind of thing. It's like a really sweet spot, economically speaking. And they have a drink called I'm Sorry Your Face.
I'm Sorry Your Face.
I'm Sorry Your Face. Never gotten it. But the difference between that and like Lovely and Amazing is just so subtle in a way. Like, you're sort of like, why are those different?
Enough Said. Great. That's another one.
Wow. Well, I hope one day to meet this person. They seem on the streets, that is. It seemed like a lovely individual.
Yeah. Well, she talks in one interview about walking her dog around Venice. So have
at it.
Well,
I'll never go there.
That's true.
I have boycotted the area. I shall never go.
We hope that all of you have a lovely and amazing evening. This is The Talking Show, signing off.
Enough said.
Well done.
Good night, everyone.